Myrna Hecht has been working for over 25 years with children, poetry, and storytelling. And she's working with children whose lives are deeply affected by displacement, by grief, confrontation with conflict, and mental distress in their lives. And she brings poetry alive and uses poetic language as poetry and also through story to really awaken the deepest response and also access places of transformation in children. Her work is utterly remarkable. And I think she's going to speak for about half an hour about her work and then allow us to really contemplate, reflect, and ask her questions so that we can all go deeper. So, Myrna, thank you so, so very much for taking the time to be with us.
And this is Elisa, well, again, just reminding people to mute, and it was star six, not pound six. Okay? Thank you.
Oh, boy, star six. Okay.
Okay, bye.
All right, Laura and everybody, hello. And Laura, thank you for your beautiful voice and beautiful words. I really appreciate it so much. And I'm honored to be back here in my living room on the telephone. And I have written a book called Companions for the Crossing. And the companions are, as Laura said, storytelling and poetry. And the crossing is from that place of loss and into hopefully a place of courage and resilience. And as all of you know, our children can and do get lost to drugs, to addiction, to suicide, to hopelessness, to so many things. It's such a precarious crossing. And so many children and young people today have lost. So one thing I've learned in this work is a tremendous trust in story and in poetry and the way that they can allow all of us, not just children, but all of us to keep company with our sorrow, and by going into the sorrow and doing what poetry and story as well have always done, which is giving us a voice to elegy, a voice to our loss, that we can make that crossing from profound loss and a shattered life into a courageous kind of resilience. And I am going to talk specifically for a while about Bridges, and that's the book that I will finish this summer, have mostly written. But I do see a tremendous connection between the refugees with whom I work and their experience of war and forced migration, losing a country, a place, a culture, and everything that goes with that, as well as loved ones. And then the children at Bridges who have all lost a family member to illness, to suicide, to homicide, to accidental or violent death. So I see a lot of similarities, and I'm just so honored to do this work. And as far as the book goes, the Companions for the Crossing book that's subtitled Bringing Storytelling and Poetry to Children Negotiating, or something like that, or Grief and Loss, what I've done in the book is I identified 10 stories that I used in that work at Bridges. And then for every story, I give my objectives, I give opening activities connected to the themes of the story, I give writing, poetry, creative drama, some art suggestions following the story, and then I give the questions that I ask to prompt those activities. And I also give suggested questions for facilitators so that the adults who work with these young people can have their own deep reflective time, which I think is so important, and do their own writing and do some deep caretaking of themselves, because as you all know, taking care of the caretaker is really important. So I've chosen one story out of the 10 that I thought I would walk through, and hopefully that will help. And then if I have time, I would love to read some poems, both by young people and the prompt poem that I used for this particular story. So the story I'm going to talk about, the one out of 10 stories in the book, is you all may know it, and if you don't, I know you'll really love it. It's The Boy Who Lived with Seals, and collected by Rafe Martin. And I'm reading directly from my reflection that's in the book. So the parents in this story are from the Native American Chinook people. And in this story, they experience many feelings together: fear, grief, hope, love. The story deals with the loss of their young son, and at the same time is very much about the continuity of life. So in the story, a young boy is, quote, called by seals to come and join them in the mysterious world that's beneath the sea, a world that really is like our human realm, but at the same time it's a strange and mysterious world. And in this world, within this story, stories of the past are told by the seals under the sea, but they also tell stories of the future. So one of the wonderful elements of this story in doing this work with these kids who are in such deep grief is that when we grieve, as we all know, time is altered. And grief takes us on a journey that's really divided into before and after. And this story does as well. So before the loss, our lives are one way, of course. And then whatever happens to us, whatever we lose, person, place, we're confronted during that loss with an upheaval, a kind of lostness. And we can become unsteady, dislocated. And even if kids can't articulate that, that's what happens. And, of course, in story, we're always dealing with that wonderful trinity, really, of the past and the present and the future. So I think that that idea that stories can be told in the future was really powerful for this group of children who lost siblings and parents. So the theme of being called, as you know, is universal throughout stories. I once heard somebody say that the call is really the mystery of inexplicable summons, and I just love that phrase. When I told this story to the Bridges group, the children were so attentive. And I think that part of that, and again, I know you all know this, but it's just profound in grief work, is this connection that children, and teenagers as well, still have to the animal world. And it's a real world to them. And when I reflected on why this story was so powerful with that group, I really feel that it's because of a young person's connection to animals, and that foot that's in the vast inner magic of childhood that stories and poetry really touch on, that can bring forth these images and this almost sense of other world that's in this story. So at the beginning of the session, I had the children go around the circle. Of course, we always sit in a circle. And each of us named an animal, the adults and the children as well. But I made it very clear to not name a favorite animal, but more an animal we wish to become. So I was thinking on that beautiful, supple imagination that young people still have that goes so far beyond the real world, that's stretching further out than we can really see. And as the children named the animals, they seemed so certain of what they wanted to become. And these are some of the animals that they really said: bear, dolphin, orangutan, eagle, giraffe. They were spoken out loud. And I had this sense of feeling the wet breath, the soft fur, the power in the wing, the grace of a long leg, this playfulness or deep wintry sleep that the children named. It's very powerful to be in the presence of children becoming animals. And there was a great sense of comfort in the room. And I think invoking animals like this really does lend this sense of belonging. And, of course, when children are feeling that disruption, that upheaval from whatever loss they've had, that kind of belonging becomes extremely important. And just as young people need to grieve, of course, the other task is to normalize, to give them back that rightful belonging to childhood and to imagination. And there are a number of heartrending moments in this story of the boy who lived with seals. One of the moments is when the parents first realize their little boy is missing. They don't know yet how long he'll be gone, what's happened to him. He's just gone. He's disappeared. And a number of children in this particular group had lost a sibling, or they lost a parent to suicide or homicide. So it was a group that had tremendous and profound losses. The causes of death varied: diabetes, as I said, homicide, suicide, cancer, medical complications. Also in the group, there were several children who'd lost a brother, and this story is about the loss of a boy who disappears from the above real world. And the psychologist at Bridges remind us what we all know, but it felt really important in terms of this story, and that this was a group where so many children had lost siblings, and that is how much our siblings define us, how much they're benchmarks for who we are, how profoundly we're shaped by our families, how death changes or loss our relationships to each other and to our community. And that's really woven into the wisdom of the boy who lived with seals. And although the boy doesn't return, which gives a sense to young listeners of the reality and the finality of death, the story imparts a great deal of solace and comfort because it ends with this beautiful, strong ending of reassurance that the parents get that the boy is at peace, because every year on the beach when they go to their fishing grounds and they make their spring migration, each year they find a more beautifully engraved and painted canoe and paddle, because this boy was a carver of tremendous giftedness and acuity. And so that lets them know that their child is okay, and they keep receiving these gifts from him. And after the story, we sequenced into guided imagery, which I did do a lot in this work with kids, and we did some close-your-eyes visualization. So when the group members reopened their eyes, I asked them, I talked them through the images in the story, and then I asked them to share the images that came to them. What did they see? What moment did they most feel? What was most vivid to them? And many of them, they don't, of course, have to speak, but many of them chose to say, and one of the boys in the group said he saw the boy jumping from his mother's and father's canoe. And when the boy does that in the story, he calls out to his parents, "Do not grieve for me. I have my own world I must go to." And that's the moment when the boy leaves his parents and he doesn't return. And this boy had lost a brother. So it was just profound and powerful and thrilling in its way that the story and the images could speak to this boy. And then another boy in the group talked about with such assurance how he had seen the old storyteller. He said it with such certainty, and he described this ancient power she had. And then it was later, when I was writing my reflection, that I realized that that was the figure I want to keep, that not only through that project, but just with me, and I know we all do. That's the one that the children really need, that timeless, comforting, daunting, wise figure. And she's just remarkable within this story, very, very powerful figure that really anchors the story. She knows the unknowable without saying how or why, and I think that lends a sense of the mystery of death to children, that they don't have to have it explained, but that somebody holds the answer, and they don't seem to need more than that. So she's clearly the one the children can trust, clearly the one that we all need. And I don't always show, in fact, I usually don't show the pictures from a story I'm telling, but the illustrations in this particular book are so compelling. The illustrator is David Shannon, beautiful work. And only after we really talked about our images did I show the children what they created. And then we talked at length about what they saw in their imagination and the power of the imagination to conjure image versus what the artist saw. And that was a really powerful experience. So that's one example, again, of I'll go back then to what my objectives were and what the activities were. So when I sit down to and take a theme, whatever the theme is, I'm in this work, I write out objectives and, again, the opening activities, et cetera. So for this one, the objectives were to provide space for expressing feelings. And, of course, that's true in all this work. If I go in with story, if I go in with poetry, I'm wanting always and first to create sacred and safe space. That's the first thing. And I know everybody knows that. And to sit in the circle and hold the space in that sacred circle, that sacred place of being and feeling. To express feelings in a deeply personal way through color, through symbol, through story, through image and poetry. That's definitely one of my goals. To provide, in this particular instance, an objective was to provide space for celebrating connections to the natural and animal world, to provide time for quiet contemplation of loss. So I in all this work, I love going where the silence is. With refugee kids, I feel like for them, the silence is in their untold stories, that we don't welcome them into our larger community and cultures, and so they need their voice. Their voice has to be heard. For grieving children, these children who've lost parents and siblings, and especially in cases of homicide or suicide, they go silent because where do they tell their story? Where is there space in a classroom for these kinds of contemplation and stories to be told? So I don't even think I have words for how important it is for these stories of grief and loss and courage and resilience that live inside of so many kids for them to be told, for that silence to be turned into voice. And then another objective of this particular group was to participate with other children in naming and claiming losses and also memories of loved ones. So obviously my opening activities were to, I always ask when I start with every group in the Bridges situation, the ritual there is to go around and have the children say their name and then say who in their family they've lost. And they do that. And then my next step, as I said, was to ask what animals call to you. And again, not your favorite animal, but to go deeper into what calls to you. Who would you want to become, that transformative element? I also asked, although I didn't say it when I read my reflection, but I also talked with the children about what places, real or imagined, call to you. Where would you feel safest? If you could be anywhere in a magical realm, like under the sea, sky, where would you be? What's that place? And that seems to, again, anchor that sense of upheaval and not belonging into more of a safe space, a belonging place. And then within the book, after every story, I do have this place of creative dramatics, writing activities, art projects, and I did have the kids, again, visualize the story, imagine scenes from the story. I asked them what comes to your mind's eye. What do you see? What does the landscape look like? What do the characters look like? How do you imagine the old storyteller in your mind's eye? What do you think the place under the sea where the seals live look like? And so I gave them lots and lots to think about and visualize. And then I went into writing. Then I went into some of the poetry writing. And then that's where I based it on gift giving. And that beautiful Native American wisdom that teaches us what we should all know about gifts, which is that true gift giving is that the gift stays in motion. Obviously, there's no profit, there's no end. We keep giving. That's continuity of life. So important for these kids. And they've got so much to give, and as do the refugee and immigrant children, so much to give. So then I asked them before we wrote, what would you leave as a gift? What symbols that represent you would you paint on something? How would you show your feelings in a poem or a painting that you would leave as a gift if you like the boy went under the sea, or if you died, just very direct, or if you could fly, whatever. Just really open up that imagination and ask the children to draw and write what their symbolic gifts would be. And then I went a little deeper and ask them, what gifts has your loved one who died left for you? And then we just wrote a simple, repetitive poem. My brother left me the gift of, the gift of, the gift of. When I think of my mother, I think of the gift of, the gift of. the gift of. So that's a kind of a walkthrough, and I would love questions about it, of one story out of the 10 in the book and the way that I've formatted and kind of what my reflections look like. And I see that I do have time to read a couple poems. So I want to read you the poem that I read after I read the story and before we wrote our own poems. And in the book, I do have a section, and it's divided into age groups, on poems for young children, middle school children. And this is from the section of poems for teens, ages 14 through 18. And it's from a book called Fire in the Sea. It is in the book with all the bibliographic information. And the poem goes like this. It's called Another Life. It's by a Hawaiian poem named Dana Neon. And it goes like this. Another life. A seal swam toward me in a dream. I saw it under the ice, following me with my mother's face. So that's where she went when she left us. We thought she would have gone to a warmer place, an ocean the color of new leaves. Instead, I saw her circling beneath the house, and the water in the cooking pots boiled twice that night. So it's kind of a mysterious poem. I just let it be. As you all know, children and, again, teenagers can abide with that. They don't seem to need an explanation. They don't seem to need the rational. They can go with that world of image. The solace in this poem is mystery. It's moved from ice to warm to cooking pot to some kind of circling under the house. The mother is left, but yet she's with us. So I think it was, and I was so delighted, and I'm always looking for poetry that goes with the theme of a story. And I can find it. They're all there. You know, the poems are there, and I've tried to include as many of those connections in the book to the theme of the story and then thematic poetry that goes with it. And I see that I have some more time, so I would also just like to read a couple more poems. I'm going to read a poem from a teen at Bridges who lost a mother to suicide that was written after this story. And then I will read, segue a little bit into the work I do with refugees and read a couple of their poems. And I think that will take up my half hour time. And I'm really eager for your questions. I really look forward to a conversation. It's really interesting talking to space in my living room. This poem is called Black Dress. I'll just give you the initials of the young woman who wrote it, NP are her initials. Black Dress. My feet have failed me. My crisp black dress has left red scratches on my arms, and my heart is filled with a black void. The sun has shone bright over the morning grass, but my eyes are clouded like the head of a thunderstorm. There I sit, willing her back against the railing, willing and wishing do nothing to flutter her cold eyes or bring color to her paling cheeks. The tears and cries of her beloved daughter do nothing to call her back from the veils she has slipped behind. Her smile will not shine like the rising sun. Her light citrus perfume will not linger in my room. Her laughter will not again infect me with giggles. I have lost her and half of my heart. It is for certain that neither will return. So I think you can definitely see the connection between that idea that the boy doesn't return and then in this poem, beautiful poem by a teenager, a 14-year-old girl whose mother took her own life. I think you can see how the story goes right into the poetry. And as a poet, I do work, you know, directly with children and teens about that beautiful sensory and specific realm of poetry so that I really help them write the particular, you know, what's that thing about your mother's smell that you miss, her light citrus perfume, her laughter. I know you can see that in the poem. Specificity of image just lives and breathes through poetry and story. The sun has shone bright over the morning grass, but my eyes are clouded, simile, like the head of a thunderstorm. And that poem is called Black Dress. And then segueing into that, I'll read a couple poems of loss and resilience as well from the refugee children with whom I work. So I say children, but these are all teenagers. They're all at a high school that right now is one of the most language-diverse high schools in the country. And many of these young people have not only lost a country and a way of life and been through the shattering experience of violence and war, but they've also lost loved ones. And in this case, this is a poem a young woman from Burma wrote about her father, who obviously died. And this was a poem. The prompt I used throughout this whole session was the idea of a story box or a memory box where we store our memories and our stories. And you can see that in this poem because the repeating line is, I will put into my box of memories. And here's how the poem goes, and this is from, again, a young woman from Burma. I will put in my box of memories the sky full of clouds and birds that could not fly, the tears falling down my face like a river, because I cannot forget that day my father died, the day my heart hurt the most, like a knife poked into my heart. It was the saddest day. My heart was broken. I saw my father's face for the last time. I will put in my box of memories the sound of rain, wind blowing, the Bigaloo River moving fast, howl, 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 a bird singing a song in a tree, and always my father who loved me. And again, that's from a young woman in Burma who lost her father. And I am watching the time, and I think I'll just read a couple more poems, and then I will stop and open it up for questions, which I'm really looking forward to. And Laura mentioned that with the refugee children, I do work with children who are coming directly from war. And I thought I would read a poem that addresses that quite specifically. And this is called War and Peace, and it's by another young woman from Burma. And it goes like this, War and Peace. I ran away to forget the things that happened in the past and think about the future. Life is hard, but it can turn easy. We had no home, no chances, no money, but we still had hope. Everything was sad, but once you have family, you will feel joy. War is dark, like the night sky, with no sunshine, because there is only killing and evil. Separating from your family is like having no breath, no time to cry. You just keep running until you find a home and peace. Hunger is like war and pain. War is a garden with no flowers. It is like being nowhere without hope from the past. Yet we still find many chances for the future. And I chose that one because I began by talking about this idea that story and poetry allow us to travel all three of those realms. Clock time, as in grief, is gone, and we're in a whole different realm of time. And I love the way this young poet was able to weave her grief of loss and war into her hope of love and joy and family. And I find that resilience in many of the poems. I have so many poems. So I'll just end by saying there are two separate books, and one book is available And that's this book called The Colors of My Past, Immigrant and Refugee Stories of Struggle, Migration, and Hope, and Poems. And if you're interested in that book, you can email me, and it's the money goes into the project, and it's $20. And then the other book is the forthcoming book, Companions for the Crossing. And I am going to stop and open it up to questions, and thank you all so much.
Myrna, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
For anybody who doesn't know, to unmute, you once again press *6. We have the instruction to mute and no instruction to unmute. So, Myrna, thank you. The poems are extraordinary.
Yeah, the poems are beautiful, aren't they?
So is the writing of the poem the last activity that you do, and then do you read them, or the young people read the poems?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I do this in bridges. I do the story first, and then we go into writing. Yes, and then we do sit in the circle, and whoever wants to read reads. And you know, as you know, what usually happens is there's often one, you know, child or teen who wants to read, and at first the others say, no, I don't want to. But then once somebody reads, then somebody else will read, and by the end of the time, usually most young people I found will read. And yesterday I was just in a facility for in a state hospital setting for a residential treatment center, and most of those kids read too. So it's thrilling when kids do that. It's a beautiful, beautiful moment.
So if you have a question, please just say your name and ask your question, which would be wonderful.
I have a question.
Yes.
My name is Sarah. I'm from Portland, Maine.
Hi, Sarah.
And I'm a writer and a teaching artist. And I'm interested in developing a workshop for children whose parents are ill or impaired.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, Myrna, if you have any specific suggestions for that type of situation where there's still a lot of...
Yeah, you know, I do. Bridges has a whole separate program, and if you want to email me, I think my email is on the, I hope it is, on the thing, but I can get my email at the end. But Bridges has a whole separate section called Discoveries Program, and it is for children who are negotiating that anxiety of maybe, you know, losing somebody to illness, that anticipatory anxiety, and I have a whole section of stories for that. That's not a direct answer to your question, and I apologize, but I could send you a list of stories that I've used with those children,
I would be happy to do that. Thank you.
So I'm just MyrnaAnna@yahoo.com.
Okay. All right, I will do that. Thank you.
Okay, please do. Please. It's MyrnaAnna@yahoo.
Okay. Thanks.
Actually, if after this, if everyone would go back on the healing story list that announced the teleconference and put their email, sent their email, we could probably have a group letter in which you could share that with all of us.
That would be wonderful, Laura. Thank you.
Four questions.
Hello?
Yeah, this really isn't a question. I just wanted to say that I decided to sign up with Healing Story Alliance after the Sandy Hook incident.
Yes.
And I also was very happy to find out that you are working from and living in the place of my birth that I have no recollection of, Tacoma, Washington. So that was interesting. So I'll let somebody else ask a question right now.
Oh, thank you, though. That's great.
Myrna, this is Elisa. I love so many aspects of this talk, and so many things jumped out at me. I don't tend to work with young children as much anymore, but as a therapist with 16 and up, and you know, with adults, I think I've done a pretty good job of helping them to form an image, a visual image of sort of a helper person, like you spoke of the storyteller, and how wonderfully grounding that was for the children to have a sense of somebody really old who held that sort of knowledge that there's more and there's a mystery, and I love the way you describe the comfort of that. And I'm wondering, with that age group of 16 to 18, what is in particular has worked for that age, who may not, in my case, they're not necessarily losing someone, but they are themselves going away, and I think it's,
yes.
So it's kind of the same.
Great question. And again, I will answer directly, but then it would be really great for me to elaborate on it, and Laura suggested in a group letter. So one story that I used that I've used with teenagers a lot is in a book that's not very well known, and it's called, and the story is, and I'll send bibliographic information from the book, but the story is called Chura and Marwe, and it's a story from Tanzania, and I find it to be one of the best coming of age initiation stories for what you're saying. And what happens in that story is that two orphan children work for some not very nice people, and they really only have each other. And at one point in the story, they're guarding a bean field. They get very hot. They take the risk to leave and go get a drink from a pool that has a leaf spinning in the middle. And when they run back to the bean field, the monkeys have decimated the whole thing. And the young girl can't stand it. And she runs away before her beloved friend can catch her, and in despair throws herself into this pond, this pool. It's very deep, and the boy can't swim. But the twist in the story that's so fantastic is the underworld where she sinks into ends up being a better place for her than the above world, and she's treated kindly there. And when the older woman who keeps her there and says, you can't go until it's time, when it's time for her to leave, she's challenged by three wise men. They give her a riddle. What would you rather have, the cold or the hot? And she realizes that she has to answer differently because her life has been so different than other people. That is so teenage. And then there's a moment in the story where she says, no matter what other people think, I will keep faith with my own wisdom and do what my heart tells me. And she chooses cold.
Nice.
She says, warm is life, cold is difficult to endure, but my life has been different. I hope I'm not talking too much. But it's such a profound story for teenagers, and you can work with it. And another story kind of like that is the Crystal Heart from Vietnam, where the guy dies of a broken heart, and only his heart is left on his bamboo mat, but then there's recompense made. I can send both of those stories to you. But that Churin, so there's a number of stories like that that are the most classic initiation stories, but without violence, you know what I'm saying? But yet that moan of despair when she does throw herself into the pond, and then the way it turns out is just beautiful. So that would be an example.
Okay.
And then there's lots of poems that, you know, go with that, and I can certainly, that's why I've got to finish this book. It's all in the book. But
how long do your sessions last?
At Bridges, the sessions were about an hour and 20 minutes, which was great.
Yeah.
And the Refugee Project, same, about an hour and a half per session.
Do you see the same young people over and over again, or is it a different group each time?
Oh, that's a great question. In the way that Bridges works is that you definitely see the same children for a number of weeks, always. Everybody at Bridges does. But then families decide when to leave. It's up to the family. And so then it changes in that way. And as terrible things happen, of course, new children come. So, but you do have some consistency. With the Refugee Project, I have the beauty of having the kids for like 4 months straight, and that's just wonderful. And that's one reason the poems go so deep, because I've got time.
Does anyone else have a question or a reflection or something that really came to mind during Myrna's talk or reading?
Hi, this is Mike Seliger.
Hello.
I was wondering, do you use the poetry in each session when you have them for these 4 months, and does it evolve, and does it get deeper? How does that work?
Okay, that's also a good question. Thank you. I tend to use the poetry a lot, and it does go deeper, and I switch themes, and I start out with the, so I'm going to be specific to the refugee kids here, because those are the ones I see for the, you know, big block of time. So I start out with some really fun things. I don't start out with poetry. I start out with an exercise we all know, you know, which is having the kids look at each other with eye contact and tell, like, one-minute stories, and having the partner be the best listener in the whole world ever and saying back what they heard and then asking further questions. So I do a lot of, you know, improv, creative dramatic things. I also do a lot of games and shout-outs where people shout out different things in their own languages, so that I have a lot of that beautiful cacophony of different languages going in the room. And I just want these kids to feel comfortable with their voices. And the eye contact piece is because, as you know, in many cultures, eye contact is not something that is condoned. It's not something people do. And I want, because I want them to be able to stand up and stand behind their voice and their work, I work on eye contact. So the first part, I'd say even for a whole month, is getting comfortable, is doing writing of memories. I have kids draw circles a lot and just draw little stick figure pictures inside of circles, a moment you loved. You're sitting at a table with your family in your country. Draw what you're eating. Just images of positive memories of their country before I go into the deeper memories, the loss, you know, the violence, the war, et cetera. So, again, I feel like I'm giving long-winded answers. But and I do some writing first in journals. We have a Kickstart grant with beautiful journals for all the kids, and we do a lot of writing your own story, imagining, just a lot of quick write first, and then I go into poetry. So I don't do the poetry at first. I do lots of preparation for it before we actually get to poems. I hope that answers your question. But I read poems to them, like, almost all the time, and I try to find poems that they can translate into their own language. So I do a lot of research to find poems, poets from Burma, poets from Somalia, poets from Eritrea, and then I ask people from that country to come up and translate the poem for me and read it back in their own language, which is really fun.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope that answers it.
Hello, my name is Janet Glantz.
Hello.
And I wonder, have you ever had any emotional things that have happened that you've had difficulty handling when you're doing these, you know, workshops with your students?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that question. You know, it's interesting. I haven't.
That's great.
And I'll tell you just quickly, at Bridges, I mean, Bridges is far and away the healthiest, most together, most wonderful place I've ever had the honor to participate in. They really understand how to hold each other in community. So I always had facilitators with me who were so beautifully trained. After every Bridges session, there is a debriefing with everybody. It's just magnificently together place. So I think that's a lot why in that setting I haven't. And with the immigrant and refugee kids, I can't say enough about the beauty of these young people and their dignity and their strength. And for whatever reason, and I'm not glorifying, I'm not idealizing, I'm not being, you know, naive, there's just this core strength that I've found so far. I'm in my sixth year of this project with these kids that is inexplicable and magnificent, and they also hold each other. It's like the world we want, because many of these kids come from religions and countries that are enemies with each other, and that is not what it looks like in the school or in the poetry sessions, and they're really figuring it out, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I think that's part of why they hold together. Again, the community holds them together, and the community of poetry and story. So there's a lot of glue there, I would say, heart glue, really strong glue.
Sounds like a wonderful
great
experience.
Question. Thank you.
I always wonder because I'm not a psychologist. I'm a storyteller, and I always wonder sometimes getting out, and I'm new to the Healing Story Network, and, you know, you have support there with you and Bridges, and I always wonder, you know, if you do this with nobody there to support you, and you're not a psychologist, you know, could there be some kind of problems that you couldn't, you know, handle yourself? That was really what I was concerned about.
Well, I think that's a really great question, and I know that, I mean, certainly Laura could address that beautifully, and other storytellers. I have had the support, which is really fortunate. I have worked places where I haven't had support. I worked in the juvenile detention center with just me and, quote, guards, you know, which is, you know, much, much more high-stakes work, to say the least. And, again, I don't want to be, like, you know, naive here, and I don't want to be frivolous, but honestly, I have seen the power of story take hold. I really mean that. Do I suggest that you just go up and do it without the support? No, I don't. But I don't suggest that at all. I think the support's really important, especially when beginning the work and getting a feel for it and learning that deep trust in the story. So I would say anybody beginning to do this work might want to make sure they do it in a setting where there is that support and holding space. That
would
be my
advice. Thank you so much.
This is Anita from Michigan. Does this now? Are you actually a therapist, or are you a storyteller, or how does it work?
Great question. I am not a therapist.
Okay.
And I am a storyteller, a teaching artist, and a poet.
Okay. So probably if we were to go out just as storytellers, and I was once a creative drama teacher, it would probably be in our best interest to take along, let's say, a psychologist who's also a storyteller. But we can do it without that too, right?
I think so. I mean, I think this is a really great issue for the Healing Story Alliance. Just, you know, a really wonderful thing to talk about. And I don't, you know, I don't definitely don't hold the answer. You know what I mean? I just think it's a great question and conversation to be put to each other who are doing this, quote, healing work. It's a really important question because we want things to go well, and we don't want to create, you know what I just said, high-stakes situation. We want situations where that sacred space is really a strong circle and really intact.
But when you really think about it, people, let's say if they're a minister or some, you know, religious figure telling, using a sermon or something like that and putting a story in it, and that story has the ability to heal, then it doesn't really matter what the credentials are.
Well, I don't think the credentials matter. I just think the sense of safety in the teller, you know, the teller's own boundaries matter, what he or she really trust. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But even then, I think you have to have the awareness that things can go wrong. You know, that somebody can freak out, somebody can get angry. I mean, in working with teenagers, that can always happen, you know.
Sure.
So, or kids as well. And, you know, there is this tremendous upheaval and inner chaos. And, you know, we're trying to normalize. I mean, that's why I use that word. I don't always like that word. I only like it in this case. We're trying to give childhood back to children and identity back to teenagers, you know what I'm saying, who don't have those things. And sometimes that could not go well. You know, I just
well, what I really...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What I really thought was interesting is when you talked about the boy who lived with seals going into a underwater situation, kind of implies, now I believe in eternal life, implies that there is a different dimension that this person is going to, and it's okay there. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
I really love that analogy.
Thank you for saying that, because one thing I didn't say about the story that's really powerful in the story is he goes once and he comes back, and then he leaves again, and he's really gone. But when he comes back, he's more a seal than a boy, and his father has to tell him, and mother as well, how to become human again. But even though he does, he's never the same because he's been to that place. That's a really powerful. Thank you for saying that, because I wanted to mention that and I forgot. That's a very important part of that story. So
okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Myrna, before we end, I was wondering, that's such an important question that was asked, what is your personal preparation or study that keeps you fresh with your sense of boundary and trust in story? Is there something that you do personally?
That's a beautiful question, Laura. Thank you. Gosh. Well, you know, I made that comment about caring for the caretaker, and I think that's so important for all of us. I don't know how great I am at it. I think most of all, what keeps me fresh in this work, and I believe in staying fresh, I don't like reboiling the porridge, I like trying new things all the time. I think most of all is what I said about all these kids that I work with. I think that in a world that does feel so broken to me in so many ways, I think it's their wholeness that's my teacher. I think what keeps me fresh is being around their courage, really, and their resilience. And there's so much energy and life energy in that. So even though I'm in the middle of all this loss with them, it's their spirit and the way the stories and poetry talk to that that gives me a sense of hope. And that's really what keeps me going.
It's beautiful. So it sounds more like you don't go there with, you have a solution and you're the healer, but you're providing the space for them.
And also, you know, a wise woman said to me a while ago, a woman who's made her 24th trip to Gaza, who's in Gaza as we speak, a nurse who's 74 years old, by the way, she said, I asked her how she lived with such grief, and she said, because I look at people, and I love them, and I understand I can only love, I can't fix. And I love that. So that's kind of exciting.
Beautiful note to end on. Myrna, could you give us your email?
Yes. My email is Myrna Anna, so it's MERNAANNA, double A in the middle, at yahoo.com.
So what if we sent to your email, not to confuse with the whole Storytel list, our emails, if we would like to sort of continue waves of reflection or share some material.
Absolutely.
And so if we sent that to you, I'm glad to put it together, because I always feel this is, with someone like you, this is so incredibly rich, and I'm sure everyone agrees.
So yeah.
It's nice to have some time to marinate and then reflect with you further.
Well, thank you, Laura. Thank you so much, back at you, for being incredibly rich, my dear. Thank you.
Well, I think we can all say thank you, Myrna.
No, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You. Lovely.
Thank you
very
so much.
Very lovely. Okay.
7 o'clock. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over
my thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.